www.thebridgeofhope.org or call 818-985-5735. Thank you for your donation now to help us all in seeking the truth.
KPFK presents a special benefit screening of When Houston Had the Blues, Sunday, September 10th at the Lemley Royal Theater located at 11523 Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles. When Houston Had the Blues is a celebration of the city that gave us giants like Lightnin' Hopkins, Big Mama Thornton, Clifton Chenier, and Bobby Blue Bland. You're invited to join us on September 10th at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. for the VIP reception, including a meet and greet with the director of the film, Alan Swire, plus Rhapsody in Black host Bill Gardner and a cavalcade of music stars from the film, including Billy Vera, Carla Olson of the Textones, Tony Bronigal, drummer for both Taj Mahal and Bonnie Raitt, and more. More information and tickets available at kpfk.org.
Now, baby, please don't go. Now, baby, please don't go.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to another episode of Gray Zone Radio. On today's show, Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate discuss Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s backing out of an Israel-Palestine dialogue he'd agreed to have with Max, and they discuss his deepening involvement with some of the Israel lobby's most extreme figures. Max also goes through a point-by-point breakdown of the Hasbara, the Israeli propaganda, that RFK Jr. spouted on the Jimmy Dore show. And after that, Michael Tracy joins us to discuss the latest farcical indictment of Donald Trump. Let's take a listen.
Robbie Kennedy Jr. went on Jimmy Dore's show. You know, Jimmy Dore has been very sympathetic to his campaign. On August 1st, after delivering a series of Likudnik tirades at pro-Israel events in New York, or marching in the Israel Day parade, his rhetoric has really escalated since he was accused of anti-Semitism for making some convoluted remarks at a private New York City dinner about genetically targeted bioweapons. He said he wasn't sure about whether they were true, but you know, this obviously fed the manufactured outrage of his opponents within the Democratic Party establishment. And so he's just been on this tirade where he thinks that if you defend the extreme right government of Israel and its occupation and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, that will somehow show that you're a friend of the Jews, as if all Jews support this, as if all Jews are ultra-Zionists. In some ways, that's an anti-Semitic construction. But regardless, I just wanted to go through what RFK actually said to Jimmy Dore and debunk some of it, because pretty much everything he said was a lie, offensive lies. Even the commas and periods in the transcript of his comments were lies. It was shocking. Yeah. And it calls into question his credibility as an anti-war candidate and in general. If you're just going to get up and just lie and just make stuff up out of nowhere, your credibility has to be questioned. And I don't care how much I agree with you on some other issue. It has to be questioned. And Jimmy, obviously, you know, he hasn't spent years. You and I have both covered this issue for years. He hasn't. He hasn't been to Palestine. He hasn't spent extended time there. Neither has RFK, but Jimmy's not pretending. The one thing you can say about Jimmy is he's not a phony. He's a real guy. And so he admits that he's not an expert on this. And so he, you know, deferred to me. RFK was kind of allowed to stampede at certain points because Jimmy didn't, just watch the way RFK is talking. It's like he's a lawyer in a courtroom and Jimmy's just being a straightforward interviewer. So anyway, I'm going to play this at 1.5 speed just so we can get through it more quickly. And we'll stop it at certain points and, you know, respond to some of this just bonkers propaganda. propaganda that you don't even hear as much from like AIPAC lobbyists. This is like extreme propaganda that, you know, you might have heard like 30 years ago from your racist Zionist grandpa.
Scenario. So you have a terrorist who you've caught, who you know knows there's a bomb that's going to kill tens of thousands of civilians. And you and the Israel judiciary has said, even in that case, you cannot torture him. No other judiciary in the world says that.
So he's saying Israel doesn't practice torture. Israel helped pioneer torture techniques, including the helicopter technique.
As you know, there's, I think, three of the 12 Supreme Court justices are Palestinians. There are Palestinian judges all over, as there are legislatures. And it's guaranteed, you know, full participation of Palestinians in the electoral process. There's 1.9 million Palestinians in Israel who vote. They elect legislatures. They're represented in the judiciary. And they practice freedom of religion.
So he's saying Palestinians are more free in Israel, the Palestinian citizens, than anywhere else in the Middle East. He doesn't know the history. For example, that there are 100,000 Palestinian citizens of Israel who are not allowed to return to the homes that their families lived in before 1948 and are internally displaced because of the absentee property law, which handed over all property left by ethnically cleansed Palestinians in 1948 to exclusively Jews through the Israel Lands Authority. The Israel Lands Authority is essentially controlled by the Jewish National Fund, which gives land exclusively to Jews. And that's why you see Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, who are Bedouins, be ethnically cleansed in areas in the Negev, like Al-Araqib, a village that I've witnessed be wiped off the face of the earth by Israeli border police. It's been demolished over 70 times, and then they're put on these kind of reservations. There's the law of return, which gives me and you, Aaron, the ability to be Israeli citizens simply because we're Jewish. But you have over 5 million Palestinian refugees who actually have roots in Palestine who are never allowed to return because Israel needs to maintain its Jewish demographic majority. So we have two countries, Palestinians have none. Then there's the racist.
And that's the key point, Max. Just to stress that he's conflating two different sets of Palestinians. So yes, there are Palestinian citizens of Israel who have citizenship and they have some nominal rights, but he's conflating them with the millions more Palestinians who live under Israeli rule in the occupied territories, who have zero rights and who are and constantly face occupation and dispossession. So their existence is completely erased from his narrative here, which itself is false because there's so much discrimination against Palestinian citizens of Israel to begin with. But even that aside, he's just in saying that they're part of the judiciary, they have rights. He's erasing the many more Palestinians who live under direct Israeli rule, but have zero votes and zero rights.
The Jewish supremacist state of Israel restricts who Palestinian citizens of Israel can marry. They are not allowed to marry thanks to the ban on unification, family unification, which is also known as the citizenship law, which was passed in 2003. They can't marry occupied Palestinians from the West Bank or Gaza. Why? Because Israel's afraid they'll make babies and they'll make too many babies and then they will outnumber Jews under Israeli state control, not Israeli military control. It's one of, according to Adala, which is a human rights NGO in Israel, an Arab human rights NGO, it is one of the most racist laws in the world. And indeed it is. It would be like the U.S. government passing a law that would restrict Americans from marrying people from Mexico, for example, or from Great Britain. And it's because Israel's national identity is defined along ethno-religious lines, which is fundamentally undemocratic. We can go on with these racist laws that Palestinian citizens of Israel face along with racist violence, but let's listen to more lies.
And they guarantee protection for gays. There was a pride parade 2 weeks ago in Israel with 150,000 people in Israel, in Tel Aviv and in Jerusalem. At the same time in Iran, they were hanging gays from cherry pickers.
Okay, at the same time in Iran, they were just hanging gays from cherry. Where's the evidence for that? He just made that up. And does gay rights give Israel the right to occupy millions of people militarily indefinitely just because gay people can parade around and dance to techno music in Tel Aviv? I mean, that is just classic pink washing. It's the kind of thing that we would only expect from neocons. I don't know what he's, you know, that there was there some recent news about Iran, like recently hanging gays from cherry pickers? And he makes it sound like hundreds of gays are just hanging in Iran.
It's the only place where women have full rights. It's the, you know, it's the only place where Palestinians can legally complain about.
By the way, women in Israel cannot get divorced, Jewish women, without a blessing from a rabbi.
Their government with no fear of reprisals. Oh, anywhere else, including the West Bank. You know, if you complain about extremely corrupt governments in the West Bank or Gaza, you risk your life and you'll face torture and death.
So right now there are massive protests in the Gaza Strip, which is controlled by Hamas government, for better conditions. They're directed against the Hamas government, and no one's being killed. Yes, those are repressive governments. People have been tortured under the U.S.-funded and Israeli-backed Palestinian Authority and are under Hamas leadership. But you can protest there. You can criticize the government without being killed. He's just making that up.
And again, how many tens of thousands, or maybe it's hundreds of thousands at this point, Palestinians have been imprisoned by Israel for resisting the Israeli occupation, whether it's nonviolently or violently? It doesn't matter. They have the right to resist regardless. That is the ultimate form of dissent, to resist an occupier. And
yeah,
for that, they're imprisoned and tortured. People spend years in prison. You know, back when Palestinians...
For protesting, for waving the Palestinian flag is now considered illegal in Jerusalem,
yeah,
in parts of, yeah, Jerusalem. Palestinians have been arrested for Facebook posts. It's the speech is heavily restricted for them. And then in the West Bank... I mean,
how many people are just shot or imprisoned for doing nothing, for just for existing as Palestinians?
I've witnessed it. You know, yeah. I've witnessed it in the small farming communities where the apartheid wall was built across their land, separating them from their own farmland. And I witnessed them being shot with rubber bullets, with tear gas, with even live bullets, being arrested in their beds, even children being arrested for simply protesting without weapons the loss of their land. And he's painting every single one of them as a terrorist.
The judiciary in Israel is unique in the world. It's also said you can't pressure people putting pressure on their family. You can't pressure terrorists in that way.
That's totally false. The judiciary in Israel authorizes the Israeli military to destroy, demolish the homes of Palestinians who have attacked Israeli military targets. That happens all the time. It's collective punishment. Israel is the master of collective punishment.
And you know what's amazing here?
I have a feeling that,
yeah,
we have, you've been playing this on whatever, like on like a faster speed than normal, and we've barely gotten into his comments, but look how many times we've had to pause him to correct him, because as you
everything
said,
he says is a lie. Literally everything Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says is a lie.
Yeah,
in this,
yeah,
interview.
And by the way, one more thing I want to clarify, Max, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you were asking to debate RFK Jr., as many people are saying. You just wanted to talk to him and have the chance to be in dialogue with him about this really important issue and come at it in good faith as someone who agrees with him on many other important topics. You wanted to have a discussion with him. As I understand it, you weren't trying to debate him, right?
Well, in the I've put in a request for an interview long ago, and yeah, they put me in the icebox. And we have a lot of viewers. We have 300,000 subscribers. Between the two of us, we have like a million Twitter followers. I mean, it would have been seemingly in their interest, but for some reason, they weren't interested in an interview. And so Jimmy kind of blindsided him here. But yeah, it could have been just you, Bobby, you say what you want. You have your time. And then I have my time. But I didn't want it to be something where I just kept cutting in on him and, you know, yeah, insulting him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
As we've made clear, and we've defended him before, there's genuine appreciation, and I know many people who watch the Gray Zone feel the same way, for his stance on other issues. For me personally, what he says about Ukraine and the proxy war, I really appreciate what he's done there. I think it's very important. He's spoken up for Julian Assange. I really appreciate all that. And it was just so shocking to me to hear what he's saying about Palestine and hear what he's saying. And I wanted to have the chance to tell him how I felt about it and actually present him with some contrary facts that I think he's missing.
And that's, fact checks.
Yeah.
Well, let's keep the fact checks.
That happens all the time. I mean, again,
you can go to jail for it.
But I'm not, you're right. But I'm not an expert.
And you can sue people.
Right. Okay. So I get your defense of Israel.
No, yeah, but I'm not, and you know, I'm not saying I'm not going to oppose, and I'm co-signing, you know, every.
But you don't mean unconditional.
No, I don't mean in that sense. I mean unconditional because we give $3.5 billion to Israel mm-hmm. every year. Now we give $2.3 billion to Egypt, which you know has no human rights, and we give $1 billion to Jordan, which has no human rights. And we give $800 million a year to the Palestinian Authority, which uses that money to pay bounties to Palestinians who kill Jews, not government officials, but Jewish civilians. So if you go to Israel.
That is just a crazy lie. But before we even touch that lie,
it gets worse.
He doesn't understand that the U.S. gives $2.3 billion to Egypt and $1 billion to Jordan in order for them to keep their own citizens under repression so that they don't resist Israel.
Yeah.
The whole point of them having repressive governments is so they don't do what their citizens want, which is to actually defend Palestinians against Israeli violence. That was the whole point of the Camp David Accords.
Yep.
But then he says that the Palestinian Authority is the U.S. taxpayer dollars are going to, through the Palestinian Authority, to pay for bounties to kill Jews anywhere.
Israel, and if you kill a Jew anywhere in the world and you're a Palestinian, the Palestinian Authority will pay you money for that. And
that is just like an insane lie. It's a laughable lie because the Palestinian Authority is paid by the U.S. to arrest Palestinians
Yes. And
essentially to defend the Israeli occupation. That's why the Palestinian Authority didn't intervene when Israel sent 2,000 troops to raid Jenin. It never does. Its only role is to arrest Palestinians, control Palestinians, and then provide Palestinians with a pseudo government so that Israel doesn't have to take responsibility for its own occupation. That's why Congress funds it. The Palestinian Authority's military side was trained by U.S. General Keith Dayton under the Dayton Plan, which was also overseen by Tony Blair at the time, and DynCorp, a U.S. mercenary firm. I've seen those mercenary trainers in restaurants in Ramallah in the West Bank, like having drinks, like they're all around. I've seen the Palestinian Authority come in to refugee camps and arrest Palestinians in the day. He doesn't understand even what the Palestinian Authority is. There's no record of them paying bounties to kill Jews anywhere in the world. And no one, and I lived in the West Bank for months and months. No one cared if I was a Jew or not. He's never been there. He's just lying.
Yeah.
And they will.
I don't know enough to push back on this.
I think most there's this narrative, and particularly on the liberal left, that says that Israel, that portrays Israel as a kind of occupying nation sitting on
It's a kind of occupying nation. Like, he's not even acknowledging that an occupation exists. It's just a left-wing narrative.
And the whole thing is a lie from start to bottom. A little bit about
he said the whole thing is a lie, that there is no military occupation. Even in Israel, they call it hakibush. That's the term for it. Even like Ariel Sharon or major Israeli generals and prime ministers acknowledge that there was an occupation. They don't deny that. They just justify it on the basis of security.
Yeah.
Israel and Jordan were created, were part of what was called the British Mandate when the Ottoman Empire, in 1922, when the Ottoman Empire collapsed after World War I, we went to war. The Palestinians were on the side of the Ottoman Empire against the Allies. The Jews were on our side. They were.
I mean, it's like he doesn't even know what he's talking about. The Palestinians didn't have any choice but to be under the control of the Ottoman Empire. It wasn't like they went to war on their side. They just were living under the Ottoman Empire during part of World War I. And they says the Jews were on our side. By the way, we weren't on the right side in World War I. World War I was a disaster that set the stage with the Treaty of Versailles for World War II because Germany was so badly humiliated. And Woodrow Wilson just used it to establish American empire. So I don't even know if he understands the history of American empire here.
But also it's like the history, it's like what does all this matter? Like, let's say Palestinians were on the wrong side back in World War I. Does that justify murdering a Palestinian kid, denying them food and medicine, stealing their home now? It's nonsensical. But again, he's going to go into the propagandistic history here, which is always
it's a weird one, though. It's bizarre. Like, I know the propagandistic history because I've, you know, seen all the Hasbara, studied it. This is something kind of original. Like, I give him credit for originality.
More Jews in Palestine at that time than there were Palestinians.
There were not more Jews in Palestine.
Such a lie.
That's just a huge lie. Yeah. That's why, you know, the Arab revolt broke out 1936, I believe, because of the Peel Commission, which was giving prime property, including the ports, to the Jewish population at the expense of the Arab or Palestinian majority. The Zionist movement would not accept UN Resolution 181 because it was going to partition Palestine in a way that would have placed 50%, it would have had an even demographic between Palestinians and Jews within what would have been Israel. That's why they needed to do ethnic cleansing, to get them out of there so they could have a quote-unquote Jewish state. So he just makes this up.
But at the end, the Ottoman Empire disappears. And so there's a lot of land that is part of the Ottoman Empire. And the question is, what do you do with that land? Woodrow Wilson and the League of Nations said, what we're going to do is we're going to give it to whoever lives there.
That's not true. It was Sykes and Picot who cut, basically through the Great Game, crafted in 1916, not at the end of World War One, but in 1916, the British mandate of Palestine. They just carved it up through a secret agreement that was signed on to by Russia. By the way, it was the Bolsheviks, when they took power in Russia, who exposed this colonial plan, which doomed Palestinians. It was along with the Balfour Declaration. The Bolsheviks exposed that. So, I mean, he's saying it was, a League of Nations, just kind of a United Nations style agreement. No, it was just raw colonialism that gave the British Empire the mandate over Palestine.
Whoever lives on that land now is the sovereign of their own country. Well, they took Palestine and they said, there's half the people, a little over half are Jews, a little under half are Arabs. So we're going to cut it in two, and we're going to give half part of the Jews, part of the Arabs. But there was so much anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic bigotry at that time that they gave four-fifths of it to the Arabs and one-fifth to the Jews, just a tiny sliver 9 miles across to the Jews, tiny, tiny little piece of land with their sacred sites that were not Muslim sacred sites ever. So
that's not what the Balfour Declaration said. I don't know where he's getting that from.
You know, that's how that was the original distribution. And then in the 48 war, when Israel got its statehood, they were immediately attacked by by Egypt, Jordan, Syria, all the surrounding countries, and Lebanon, and miraculously beat them off. The Palestinians were on the side of the attackers.
They were on the side of the attackers in 1948, when over 400 Palestinian villages were ethnically cleansed. Over 700,000 Palestinians were forced off their land into oblivion. They were on the side of the attackers. Like, he doesn't even acknowledge the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing. 200 villages had already been ethnically cleansed, including major urban neighborhoods, by the time Israel signed its quote-unquote Declaration of Independence in 1948. Then the 1948 war, he said, Israel just won miraculously. It didn't win by a miracle. The government of Egypt, which was a fake government, a fake monarchy, did not actually attack the Zionist movement or what would become Israel. It was basically a volunteer force. The only real force that attacked was the Royal Jordanian Legion, which had been trained by a British military expert, Pasha Gloob. And through a secret agreement that was actually negotiated by Ben-Gurion with then King Abdullah, they agreed to stop at the Latrun Gap, at this line, and they would get part of Jerusalem, what is now East Jerusalem, and Israel would essentially be created. They didn't continue on. There was no other real force fighting Israel. And then what Israel proceeded to do in 1967 was, and we'll get to this part of his lie fest, Hasbara fest, is ethnically cleanse the villages that it couldn't get to in the Latrun Gap so it could build a highway between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, Beit Nuba, Inwas, and Yalu. And it forced the citizens there at gunpoint to march to Ramallah, and then destroyed all of their villages and all their homes. And then the Jewish National Fund built a forest called Canada Park with a Canadian government grant on those villages, an artificial kind of forest, so that they could never return. He doesn't know anything about this. This is like the Leon Uris Exodus propaganda version. He watched some movie with Paul Newman.
The key point here in response to what he said, I think, is that when he talks about the Arab states attacking Israel, at the time that the Arab states finally entered the war, Israel had already expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes and ethnic cleansing campaigns, as Max was talking about. So this idea that Israel was founded and then the Arab states decided to get together and just attack it to erase it from the map. No, they intervened after months and months and months of Israel ethnic cleansing Palestinians and stealing their homes and forcing them to flee. And then the myth was that was created was that the Palestinians decided to voluntarily leave their homes to help yeah. their Arab allies attack and kill the Jews. It's also cartoonish or ridiculous. If you don't believe all the Palestinians who still have the keys to their original ancestral homes, who can never go back, if you don't believe them, there's plenty of archival evidence of this, including from Israeli historians. It's all admitted. It was all planned to commit ethnic cleansing, and that was the real plan.
And they massacred them in Tantura. They massacred them in Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin, by the way, they built a mental institution over the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin. The people of Deir Ashkelon, which is now Ashkelon, were rounded up, placed in a concentration camp until 1950, surrounded by barbed wire, and then they were taken in trucks and dumped in the Gaza Strip, where they their offspring now live in an open air prison. The reason they can't return to what is now Israel is because they're not Jewish. So,
the real honest Israeli historians are people like Benny Morris, who say yes, there was ethnic cleansing, but he says it was necessary. So at least he acknowledges the fact of what happened. He just happens to be enough of a bigot and a chauvinist to justify it. Whereas
he said it was necessary and we didn't do enough. That's the problem.
There we go. Yeah.
Yeah.
So RFK needs to read people like that who ideologically he's aligned with, but at least are more honest on the actual facts.
In all of those countries, all the Jews were expelled. So all of those countries expelled every Jew in the country and took away.
I mean, do we need to go into this? I mean, there was the Levon affair. There was the bombing by the Zionist underground movement in Baghdad of Jewish community centers. The Zionist movement actually encouraged terrorism inside those countries against Jewish people or destabilization actions in order to precipitate the exodus of their Arab Jewish population, because they would absorb them and start, you know, using them as human fodder in the demographic trench war against Palestinians.
Something like 27 million square miles of land were just taken away from them. And those Jews were all sent to Israel. Israel did not do that to the Jews, to the Palestinians in Israel. It allowed them to stay.
Did you already he said Israel did not do that to the Palestinians inside Israel. It allowed them to stay. I mean, he just straight up denied what happened in 1947, 1948.
I was in Lebanon a few years ago, and I went to a Palestinian refugee camp, and you go there, you talk to people, everyone's got a story about what happened to them or to their family members who were kicked out of their homes. They still have the keys to their homes that they can't go back to. And that's Palestinians all around the world. Does he think they're all lying? Does he think all the Israeli historians who have documented this in meticulous detail based on the Israeli archives, that they're all lying? I mean, it's insane what he's saying, and we really can't stress that enough.
He's running to unite Americans. Do Arabs exist in America? Do Palestinians exist in America? Yeah. I mean, these are just like, this is the moral equivalent of Holocaust revisionism to them. And he's just completely denying their history, their humanity. And then he's claiming that he's running for all Americans.
Well, it's been attacked. It was then attacked in 67. And the,
We've advanced 5 seconds and you get another. Israel also was false. Attacked in 1967. Israel attacked in 1967. It destroyed the entire Egyptian Air Force before Egypt was able to do anything or had any plans to do anything.
Yeah, and Israel claimed it was preemptive because all the Arab states were planning on attacking it. When meanwhile, Israel had been shelling parts of Syria to try to get a reaction because they wanted all these countries to attack because they want an excuse to then occupy the land, which they exactly did. So 67 is a great example. Israel says it's a defensive war, but somehow in the so-called defensive war, Israel ends up stealing all this land that it really covets. It takes the Golan Heights from Syria. It takes the Sinai and it takes the West Bank and Gaza. How many defensive wars end up with a country that's on the defensive stealing and occupying more land than it had when it began? It's incredible. And I mean, again, there's so much scholarship done on this too. It's like, even in Israel, I don't even know if this argument is made anymore.
Well, even in Israel, they say, well, it was a brilliant, like Michael Oren wrote this propagandistic chronicle of the 67 war. And he acknowledges that Israel attacked first, but he said they did so because it was out of strategic necessity. But RFK doesn't even know that they attacked first. Yeah. They started the war.
And from its attackers, the Palestinians, again, were on the losing side.
Oh, they're on the losing side. So they get to have all of their stuff taken, all of their land taken. That's what we do. If you lose, it's just a Hobbesian world where the more powerful military force gets to take everything and militarily control you indefinitely because you're the loser.
But it took strips of land from the attackers, which is the West Bank, Gaza, Sinai, and the Golan Heights. And then Israel said, look, we want to give it all back. But we're not going to give it back because you can attack us from those parts. We're not going to give it back unless you promise us peace. If you renounce violence and us, if you admit that we have a right to exist, we'll give it back. Egypt said yes. And Syria got the Golan Heights and Sinai, and they got it back.
Do you hear what he just said?
Syria got the Golan Heights? That's news to Syria. Yeah.
That would be news to Donald Trump, who got his own settlement named after him in the occupied Golan Heights, Trump Heights.
And as you said earlier...
He doesn't even know that the Golan Heights is still occupied by Israel.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, Egypt made peace with Israel. And what Egypt got was basically Egypt agreed to neutralize itself and no longer stand up for Palestinian rights. That's basically why Egypt got a peace deal. It wasn't about recognizing Israel or basically. And Egypt also got bribed with billions of dollars in annual U.S. aid. That's another thing that Egypt got. And this idea that Israel should be trying to give all the land back. And he goes more into this. He repeats the lies about the Oslo peace process and the Camp David Accords.
Egypt got the Sinai Peninsula because they attacked Israel in 1973. They liberated their own territory where Israel was building settlements in a surprise attack that was masterfully planned. They also sold out Syria so that it didn't get the Golan Heights because they wanted to be at the only people at the table in Camp David. So he doesn't even know the basics of this history. He doesn't even know what happened in the 73 war.
Wouldn't do it. Oh, you know, they and today... You have, you know, the Palestinian Authority, and in Gaza, if you kill a Jew, you get a street named after you. The children are taught.
What?
That's projection. If you kill Palestinians, you get squares named after you. You get stadiums named after you in Israel.
Yeah.
That's.
I mean, there are memorial monuments to the Etzel Brigade and Lehi and all of the right-wing terrorist groups that participated in the Deir Yassin massacre all over Tel Aviv, including the Etzel Museum, which was built on the ruins of the ethnically cleansed neighborhood of Manshia, which is just south of Tel Aviv.
Yeah. But from kindergarten, killing Jews is an act of patriotism and 85% of those countries.
They're taught, Palestinian kids are taught from kindergarten that killing Jews is an act of patriotism. I mean,
people in those countries when polled believe that it's okay to kill civilian Jews. And that it's okay, and that Israel has no right to exist, and their purpose is to destroy Israel and to exterminate the Jewish people. Now, Israel, on the other hand, only deliberately attacks military targets. So civilians do get killed. But for example, in Jenin, you know, in the recent battle,
it only deliberately attacks civilian targets. So here's one of the like the clips that, well, this was, I mean,
look at the film I co-produced,
Killing Gaza, just puts the lie to that. But here's, you know, my first day in Gaza. I'll show some, like, I'll have to
like in 2014, in the assault on Gaza in the summer, I'm thinking of like when they attacked UN refugee camps, those four Palestinian boys playing soccer on the beach, all these residential homes, residential apartment buildings leveled. There's just countless examples of this. And
this was my first day in Gaza. Like, this is a picture I took of the neighborhood of Shujay. It was completely leveled to the ground by the Israeli military.
Yeah.
Completely leveled. Everything there was destroyed by Israeli howitzers. And beyond it is Israel and the buffer zone.
And again, and when he even says it's the word military target, I mean, even that is misleading because Palestinians don't have a military. They're a group of people who are resisting a military occupation. They don't have an army. They don't have, heavy weaponry that they can launch at Israel. They have homemade rockets, and they have people who are defending their own territory and resisting an occupation, an occupation he doesn't even seem to be aware of, or doesn't want.
Here's Shuruk Tower, blown up by Israel in the Gaza Strip. This is a major office tower and residential tower, and it's home to media offices. I know because I've worked out of that building. I've been up and down that building. It's home to families who rent.
Yeah.
It has no military value at all. Israel attacks it as part of its Dahiya doctrine, which is designed to, it's named for an entire neighborhood in southern Beirut that Israel destroyed. And it's designed to demoralize the population so they turn against their leadership, and it's failed every time. It has a literal doctrine of attacking civilians. I mean, I don't even know if we need to. He goes on to defend the Israeli raid of 2,000 soldiers on the refugee camp of Jenin, where hundreds of people were wounded, thousands of people had to evacuate. He claims no civilians were killed. That's totally false. And I mean, they destroyed the hospital there. It was bombed by jet, by helicopter. There were, you know, tanks rampaging through the town. And he says, Jenin is a bomb factory. Israel didn't even raid Jenin because of suicide bombings. There hasn't even been a suicide bombing campaign since the early 2000s. And the last suicide bombing I could think of was 2007. It was because they're forming armed resistance factions that aren't controlled by the Palestinian Authority and are defending their own territory against Israeli military and settler incursions. Either he doesn't know that, or he just believes propaganda. But I mean, I think we can kind of just...
The last thing I want to say, I just want to say one more thing on this, and then we can move on, is during this interview, he also talks, and we saw a bit of it there, he talks about Israel's always been trying to give the land back, and they've offered Palestinians all these generous peace deals, which these greedy Palestinians who want to destroy Jews have always rejected. It's a complete myth. And there's a long story. You know, I've covered it a lot before, but it's such a lie. And it's a lie that's trotted out to justify the ongoing occupation and U.S. Israeli policy since the second Intifada, and basically cracking down on the Intifada and increasing the colonization of the West Bank. Anyway, Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the Israeli foreign minister at the time of Camp David, the peace talks in July 2000, brokered by the U.S. between Ehud Barak of Israel and Yasser Arafat of the Palestinian Authority. Shlomo Ben-Ami was Ehud Barak's foreign minister, okay? And Camp David is supposedly, according to the narrative that RFK Jr. was parroting, Israel offered Palestinians this generous peace deal that would have satisfied all their national aspirations. It would have given them East Jerusalem as their capital, most of the West Bank, all of the Gaza Strip. That's the narrative that RFK Jr. promoted. Shlomo Ben-Ami, who was the foreign minister, the Israeli foreign minister, he said on Democracy Now! When I was there, he said, if I were Palestinian, I never would have accepted Camp David. Because he pointed out accurately that the actual Israeli offer was simply to keep all the major West Bank illegal settlement blocks, Jewish-only settlement blocks, carve up the West Bank so that Israel takes what it wants, give Palestinians the rest, and rather than giving Palestinians even parts of East Jerusalem, to basically take a suburb of East Jerusalem that's not even actually East Jerusalem and rename it East Jerusalem. And that could be the Palestinians' new capital. And this is like, if you're a Palestinian right there, this is like the center of Palestinian cultural life is Jerusalem. And Israel was asking Palestinians to basically take an adjacent place and rename it Jerusalem and call that their capital. So that's a lie, just like everything else RFK Jr. says. And as someone who really admires what he said on so many other issues, especially the Ukraine proxy war, I was shocked listening to it. And it's disappointing, but I'm not surprised at all that he declined the opportunity he claimed he would take to discuss this with you, Max. And I hope he changes his mind.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he is. And his communications director was not indicating that he's going to debate anyone except for Joe Biden. But just in closing, I mean, RFK did respond to a challenge by an interviewer at one point. I'll tweet it out later. He said, you know, if you can debate me and show me that the facts and where I got it wrong and change my mind, then I will admit that I'm wrong. But if you can't, then I'm right. Well, I mean, that's what we're doing here. And he's not going to change his mind. He just hired the fanatical Morton Klein, or brought him on as his Israel director. Morton Klein is a guy whose Zionist Organization of America fell apart because, just like with Shmuley Botiek, fell apart because of financial, unethical finances. And Sheldon Adelson came in and rescued it. So he's bringing on all these Sheldon Adelson-funded characters. Morton Klein has publicly denounced Palestinians as filthy Arabs on his Twitter account. He's just a racist. He knows he's a racist cretin. And if he's going in that direction, he doesn't want to know what the facts are. And I have to question his credibility as a peace candidate if he's doing this, pushing for war with Iran, spreading lies like the one he told in Congress, where he said that it was a genocidal program that the U.S. gave $2.8 billion to Iran. He was actually referring to the U.S. giving a sanctions waiver to Iraq so that Iraq could pay Iran for gas that it received. So he's referring to cross-border trade between Iraq and Iran as a genocidal program. He has no idea what he's talking about. And, you know, just because I'm disgusted by the lockdowns and the mandates and everything that RFK correctly opposed, it doesn't mean I'm just going to give him a pass on this major issue, which really is paramount as an American. I'm also offended as a Jew that he somehow thinks that if he expresses the most extreme ultra-Zionist position, it's going to make him seem like a friend of all Jews. That's that's not the way Jews think, and we're not all the same. But I'm out of there, man. Like, I don't believe in politicians. They all need to be held accountable. And just because you're running against Biden doesn't mean I'm going to just give you a free pass.
You've been listening to Max Blumenthal and Aaron Maté discuss Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s crazy Zionist propaganda spree that he's been on recently. Next up on Gray Zone Radio, Max and Aaron are joined by Michael Tracy to discuss the latest farcical indictment of Donald Trump. Let's take a listen.
Michael, welcome.
Hello, I'm biting my tongue about the RFK Jr. stuff. I don't want to return to that discussion, but I should just bite my tongue.
Let's just say you were skeptical of RFK Jr. from the start.
Can I just say one quick thing?
Sure, go ahead.
If his thinking or if his logic is so obviously, disordered or incoherent on this subject, is it really that much of a stretch to think that he might have arrived at other positions which you might circumstantially agree with by a similarly kind of incoherent thought process? I mean, there's no real tangible, at least as I've seen it, kind of through line between his views on things. But everybody is just so desperate to say, oh, thank you for raising this issue that I really agree with, when it doesn't. I mean, you have to kind of step back and analyze the candidacy as a whole to see if you're just being pandered to. And I don't know. I hesitate to reward pandering.
To me, I've seen it happen a lot. People get duped very easily. And I like to believe that he was duped on this issue. And
how many times does the guy have to be duped? He's 70 years old. He told Glenn Greenwald, oh, yeah, I got duped by Russiagate. And then Glenn's like, oh, yeah, isn't that wonderful that he got duped by Russiagate in his late 60s? But now at 70, he finally saw the light. And we're supposed to be impressed by that and view that as a credential for him running for president, not as a demerit. It's a merit.
Right.
Michael Tracy started this commentary by saying, can I say something real quick?
Okay, yeah, let's move on.
Which is the biggest lie you've ever told. No. I'll say real quick, in 10 seconds, RFK Jr.'s in a way playing a positive role by just making this debate possible and allowing us to get some traction here. If he wasn't there, I'm not saying based on what he's saying.
His fantasy is predicated on a total myth, which has to do with his family lineage. That's the only reason he's been running in the first place. It's not because he's like a brilliant philosopher king that he figured out all the remedies for fixing our ailing.
Michael, he has a track record. He has a listen. This is the last debate I want to have. Because I'm really he has a track record as an attorney who has done something. It's not just this guy. Anyway, but listen, I think we should move on because we brought you on to discuss
bring you back to talk about that. But
I'm not supposed to be interviewing myself at some point, so maybe I should just move on. I was
about 20 minutes. wait, stop. We have 20 minutes.
Okay, let's go.
Michael Tracy, your thoughts on the latest Trump indictment. Just go.
Yeah, I mean, the first thought is that if you read it, it's an incredibly zealous criminalization, outright unabashed criminalization of what had previously been understood universally to just be ordinary political speech and political conduct. Now, obviously, Trump attempting to do what he did in the aftermath of the 2020 election and contest the results in a variety of ways was not ordinary as a whole. But the actions that he took in isolation, meaning to criticize the Secretary of State of Georgia or to attempt to express certain political grievances around the manner of election administration in Arizona or Wisconsin, whatever, those on their own are not particularly extraordinary political acts or incidences of political speech. But now Jack Smith, the prosecutor, has concocted this overarching theory that posits that all that conduct taken in totality could be seen as now a criminal conspiracy. And that really is an alarming aspect of this that's, on a kind of broad-based level, really ought to give people pause.
And one of the things you pointed out was that we've been primed for years now to believe that Trump committed incitement and that he would be charged for that. But yet, as you point out, that charge incitement is not mentioned at all in the indictment.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you remember this phony baloney January 6th House Committee, special committee on January 6th that was co-chaired by Liz Cheney, put out a report in December of last year where they meticulously and tediously went through every last little detail of what they claim transpired on January 6th and in the run-up. And their ultimate recommendation, even though they had no power to do so, it's not like Congress authorizes these committees to make criminal referrals, but they claim that they had the power to issue a criminal referral. And one of the crimes that they referred, quote unquote, to the Justice Department was incitement of insurrection, because there is a federal statute there is a provision of the federal criminal code that does make a crime the incitement or the commission of an act of insurrection or rebellion. So that was what was proposed as something that the Justice Department could charge Trump with by the January 6th House Committee. Now, Jack Smith has not gone along with that. He had the option, in other words, Jack Smith, of formalizing and ratifying this idea that January 6th constituted an insurrection and Trump was the insurrectionist in chief, but he chose not to. And yet that's not going to make anyone question whether this term that's been propagandistically inundating us for the past 2.5 years actually is accurate, even though, in the one test that would have actually been constituted some kind of adversarial format for adjudicating whether insurrection is the right term, the prosecutor balked and decided not even to go with that statute.
So what's in the indictment that you find so objectionable? I read some, as I said, I've been on the road, so I haven't had a chance to read the indictment. I've been reading a lot of children's books to my kid, however. And so I've read some of the parts you've screenshotted. At one point,
that's all you need. Just
well, you did hit on some very curious passages. One which says that Trump knew that the election had not been stolen from him, and he had been informed that it had been not stolen from him, and yet he proceeded anyway to tell his followers that it had been stolen. So how did they know that Trump knew that, and where is the crime there? What else are you finding in the indictment that's objectionable?
Yeah, so one of the novel theories that they've concocted in order to prosecute Trump on these grounds is they assert, meaning the prosecutors, assert that Trump knowingly lied, meaning he knew that his claims about January 6th or about election fraud or about the impropriety of the election results, he knew them to be false and yet made the claims anyway. With the theory being that transfers Trump's speech outside the realm of political speech and into fraud, which therefore makes it criminalizable in the way that it wouldn't be if it was just Trump making a contested political claim and then, others disagreeing with it or making their own contested political claim to counter it. Now, there's no evidence cited that Trump knowingly lied about anything that he said regarding January 6th, other than they cite Trump being told or informed that what he was saying was apparently untrue or allegedly untrue by members of the Justice Department, by certain of his campaign advisors, by Mike Pence, by a whole gamut of other people, that somehow it's meant to be probative of Trump knowing that what he was saying was false. Now, even if a politician does knowingly make a false statement, it's unclear, very unclear whether that could constitute a criminal act. Otherwise, you're criminalizing politicians lying, which is kind of a regular occurrence. But even beyond that, I mean, Trump's conduct doesn't really make a whole lot of sense as I see it if he did not, on some level, genuinely believe what he was saying. Otherwise, why would he have taken such extreme action? I mean, do you get the impression that Trump secretly knew all along that there was no election fraud in the 2020 election? That's not the impression I ever got.
Well, if Mike Pence says something to you, it has to be true.
Yeah, but that's the novel theory that the prosecutors have gone with. And interestingly, Jack Smith, before he became the special counsel overseeing these dueling Trump investigations, so Jack Smith, remember, also has presided over this classified documents case where he resurrected the Espionage Act to charge Trump. Jack Smith, prior to November of 2022, was on loan from the U.S. to the International Criminal Court at The Hague, where he was the lead special prosecutor for the Kosovo Tribunal. So the U.S. allowed for several years, for actually several decades, has allowed for U.S. personnel to be used in international criminal court proceedings pursuant to Kosovo, because it's one of the exceptions they carved out that permitted U.S. engagement with the International Criminal Court. And Jack Smith, lo and behold, was the person who was in that role. And in international law, international human rights law, as they put it, whatever you might want to say about it, at the very least, it's pretty much universally acknowledged that there aren't a whole lot of binding precedents, meaning you kind of make it up as you go along. It's not like you have a constitution. It's not like you have a U.S. constitution that bars you from taking certain prosecutorial action because it would violate the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, et cetera. It's basically just at the whim of the prosecutor or at the authority that's in power. And that's what Jack Smith had been doing for the preceding 4 years before he was brought over by Merrick Garland to take on these Trump investigations. Hence, the kind of sprawling, freewheeling creativity that Jack Smith has used to go after Trump on January 6th, and then also the documents case where they decided that for the first time ever, a dispute over the retention of presidential records was going to be swiftly transformed into a criminal matter, whereas there really had been no expectation that was even going to possibly take place prior to
similar with the hush money payments case too. That's also the first time that legal theory, whatever it is in that case, about Trump classifying his payments to Stormy Daniels in a certain way, that now constitutes a felony as opposed to a lower charge.
Exactly. I mean, so what does that tell you? If we're now at the third, and we're going to get a fourth, but we're now we're at number three of the indictments that are predicated on the construction of these elaborate, convoluted new legal theories that were created solely to apply to Trump. Like, it's not as though Trump robbed a bank or something and then was charged with the statute that would ordinarily govern the robbing of a bank or be used to prosecute people who rob banks, right? No, they've manufactured or confabulated brand new legal theories in now three separate instances specifically to charge Trump. And the New York case is another example of that. They literally assert in that case that Trump defrauded himself by entering into his own corporate ledgers a description of payments that he had made for the made to Stormy Daniels to allegedly hush up his affair with Stormy Daniels. So he defrauded not the state of New York, not taxpayers, not the campaign finance board of New York or the Federal Campaign Finance Commission. Trump defrauded himself. I mean, look at the indictment. It sounds crazy when I'm describing it, but that's what they did. And this is a clear trend with the January 6th indictment this week, probably being the most dramatic example of a brand new legal theory developed basically out of thin air for no purpose other than to target Trump.
Yeah, and this comes after they framed him as a Russian agent and consumed his presidency with that. And then when they realized there was nothing there, then they pivoted to accusing him of obstruction of the investigation into the fake claim he was a Russian agent, which again, also they had nothing there either, because Robert Mueller, who investigated all this, declined to even make a call on whether or not he committed obstruction. He just put it out there that he might have committed obstruction. These are some possible cases. And this was part of a multi-year campaign, as you pointed out, long before January 6th happened, where Democrats were openly calling for Trump's prosecution. In fact, I believe they were basically calling for his impeachment since the day he took office, if not before. And
pretty much, yeah.
It's like we're expected to forget all that context every time one of these new indictments is handed down.
You've been listening to Gray Zone Radio. Max Blumenthal and Aaron Mate were joined by Michael Tracy to discuss another ridiculous performance in Wall Street's comedy sideshow, also known as American Politics. This was the latest Trump indictments. To hear the rest of their entertaining discussion, check out the Gray Zone's YouTube channel and visit thegrayzone.com. That's thegrayzone.com to sign up for our newsletter, to be notified of future live broadcasts, and read real independent journalism. You can also visit the Gray Zone's YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, or Telegram to find links and follow for more content. This show is co-hosted and produced by me, Chris Weaver.
Hi, everyone. I know you've heard our fundraisers and likely thought, yeah, I should likely give something back to KPFK. Well, now's the time to do it. We all understand the value of separating luxuries from necessities and deciding what's truly essential. KPFK is one of those essentials. We provide in-depth, cutting-edge, intelligent coverage, and it starts with our amazing staff and volunteer programmers and with your financial support. Contributions from our listeners add up to the largest share of funding that pays the bills here at KPFK. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, encouraging you to become a KPFK Sustainers Circle member now. A sustaining contribution of just $20 or more a month is one of the most popular levels for our donors, and it takes just minutes to contribute. Just go to kpfk.org/support, then click Sustainer Circle, or call 818-985-2711. Thank you so much for your donation to KPFK, radio powered by the people.
Please help keep independent journalism alive and KPFK Radio strong. Become a Sustainer Circle member of KPFK by pledging at any level. $10, $20, $100 per month, whatever suits you. This is Verdeen White of Earth, Wind & Fire, encouraging you to make your tax-deductible donation today at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
Andrew Tonkovich, host of Bibliocracy, KPFK's weekly literary arts program. Listeners value this station's commitments to news and analysis, our shared political struggles, and celebrating the arts. Support my books program and this station, a singular community media resource, during our fund drive by calling to donate at 818-984-8255.